my friend, Dr. Huil Gore, has asked me to speak to you about what social service medical men could render. I am a layman and have always tried so far as possible to steer clear of medical men. I was once invited to open a hospital in a village. I said, how could I inaugurate, being not a patient myself? I was not qualified to inaugurate your hospital. And they asked me to bless them. I said, I pray to God to bless your hospital with a blessed emptiness. May you have no patients, and may the village be so healthy as not to need the aid of a doctor. So all I can say, the best service that a doctor can render society is to make medical aid a real social service, to deliver it, to rescue it from the mire of glamorous commercialism, and save it from becoming a commodity for sale and barter. Friends, when social service or any service becomes a commodity, it ceases to have any value. It can give you neither job satisfaction nor the satisfaction of having rendered any service to anybody, far from rendering any service to society. We are living in an age when everything is sold as a commodity. Our intelligence, our art, our knowledge, our faculties, our labor, and even our gods, they are all sold as commodities. And in this context, in which everything becomes a commodity, the greatest social service that we all can render society is to rescue social service from the price tag of the marketplace. Today, everything has its value, but not social value. What has become more important is the market value. We call it market value. If a thing has an exchange value, a market value, it is wealth. Otherwise, it is regarded as mere trash, virtually having no importance in life. So I think the first task that we have got to address ourselves to is to change the social context. If social service becomes a commodity due to the present capitalist context, it will become not only a disservice, but a sin, an anti-social agency. This is particularly true two professions, the profession of the lawyer and the profession of the doctor. They are more professions than vocations. I belong to a pretty large family, and I have several doctors in the family and quite a few advocates or lawyers. I am the father of a lawyer and the grandfather of a lawyer. And I, when I was asked to address the Bar Association at Bangalore, the first thing that I asked them to remember was that the lawyer was to become a tribune of the people and not merely a middleman between two contesting parties. The lawyer thrives on feuds, family feuds, property feuds, and feuds of all descriptions. My uncle was in quest of a suitable place for starting his practice, and he chose a small taluka town which was yearly visited by cholera, because he said his practice could only thrive in a place which was susceptible to epidemics almost regularly, yearly. So the doctor lives on feuds, and the lawyer and the doctor lives on the ill health of his neighbor, of his fellow men. I have therefore regarded some of these professions, which according to the capitalist context have become anti-social. A lawyer's profession is anti-social because the lawyer is interested more in making people quarrel than in preventing quarrels. The doctor, for whom treatment and medicine are professions, is more interested in people's illnesses than in their well-being. Capitalism is a system, it's an order of society in which we have what is known as the conflict of interests. One man's meat is another man's poison. One man's difficulty is another man's opportunity. So everyone is interested in the difficulty of his neighbor. Therefore, no profession and no function in life has any human or social value. And we are living in an age of specialization. Specialization is fragmentation. A fragment of a man meeting a fragment of another man in on the fragment of an occasion. A teacher once asked his class, whom are those men who, after seeing an elephant, described him differently? One said he seemed to be like a pillar, another said he seemed to be like a rope Still another said it was, he was like a fan. And still another, like something which did not understand but felt soft and long. Who were these men? The traditional student answered, as it is related in the fable, that they were all blind men. But the modern, up-to-date student who had more wits said they were specialists. Because they could not view the whole elephant. The specialist concentrates his attention on a particular limb of the body. He has no view, integrated view, of the whole body. A man who was suffering from ophthalmological trouble once visited an ophthalmologist for treatment. And the ophthalmologist asked him to undergo several tests before he could examine him. The poor man, in all innocence, asked whether he would treat both the eyes or only the right eye or the left eye. So specialization precludes an integrated view of life as a whole. I am talking to doctors and medical men, therefore I am taking examples from your life. If I were talking to other audience, I would take some instances from their life. So what we have got to do is to render medicine and legal aid as not functions which require an exchange value, functions which have an exchange value. Exchange value means either barter or sale. Everything is auctioned. Even worship in the temples has become a profession. It must have an exchange value. Get something in return. Every service is done for some consideration in return. And service is really help which is rendered without any thought of return or any thought of consideration in return. This is what service means. But service in the present context, in which everything is done for some consideration in return, can never be service. Service is service to your neighbor. What is society? Social service is rendered to your neighbor. And who is your neighbor? Your neighbor is not only the man who lives next door, but your neighbor is the man who is in distress, who is in misery, who is suffering from want, who is suffering from social disabilities, who is suffering from social ostracism. Such a man is your neighbor. Every man who needs another man's help, however far he may be on this globe, is your neighbor. Neighborhood has no geographical limitations, no geographical boundaries. So we have got to be real neighbors to our fellow men. Relationship is society. Otherwise, society is a sociological myth which doesn't exist everywhere. anywhere. Every man that you may ask has a grouse against society, against his neighbor, the Joneses and Mrs. Grundy, who never cease blaming him. So every man complains against society, but where is society? Society really is your neighbor. And your neighbor is the most difficult being in the world to love. That is why all religions have enjoined on us the duty of loving our neighbor. Because he is the most difficult person to love. We choose our enemies, we choose our friends, but fate chooses our next door neighbor. Chance gives us our next door neighbor. A mere accident. And one man who was disgusted with the situation once said, "It seems accident is the pseudonym. The pseudonym that God assumes when he does not want to sign. If the Almighty does not want to affix a signature to any event, he leaves it safely to chance, to fate. So your neighbor may be anybody. And since he is anybody, he is everybody. He is the specimen of humanity given to you. That is why it's the most difficult thing in the world to live with your neighbor. This is a very strange world. Strange and equally romantic and beautiful because it is full of contradictions. Man cannot live without a neighbor, and man doesn't live with his neighbor. You want a neighbor, but you cannot love him because he is your neighbor. And this is the most difficult part of social service. Gandhi, in his peculiar style, used to define Swadeshi as neighborliness, the service to your neighbor, the service to the man in pain, to the man in distress, wherever he may be. So that broadens our horizon of life, our view of life. It lifts us from the narrow boundaries to a view of humanity as a whole. This I call the familistic or the familial view of life. We have to make progress from the department store towards the values of the home. The department store has everything that a home is expected to have. But the department store stores things for sale. It doesn't give you anything because you need it. It wouldn't give you anything unless you have the money to pay for it. So, a capitalist society is a huge department store where every home is also a department store. Not only every home, but every church, every temple, and every mosque. In this context, context of the marketplace, everything becomes a commodity. A commodity in which life has no value. Whereas in relationship, life is the supreme value. The function of the doctor, as a matter of fact, is to preserve life, to enhance the value of life. To a doctor, the life of the pauper must be as valuable as the life of the prince. This is a humanistic outlook, the outlook of the democrat. In a democracy, the president of India and the sweeper on our streets has one vote, and the value of their votes is just the same. There is no difference in the value of the vote of the sweeper or the president of India. This is the view regarding reverence for life, all life. All life, however small, however mean, or however high and sublime. From other points of view, from the point of view of the doctor, life is life. Man is man. But if one who is ill, suffering from a serious disease, is unable to get treatment or medicine without purchasing it, he will be allowed to die. Capitalism means an order of things in which the basis of distribution is purchase and sale. Unless you have the purchasing power, you are unable to get anything that you need. Even the food, if you are hungry, it is the man with purchasing power who can purchase food. The man with a cudgel who can rob you of it, or the man with political power who can grab it. So things can be purchased, they can be forcibly snatched, or they can be grabbed, but never got for the asking. That is why in the present social order, so many men, more men than not, are deprived of the primary amenities of life. To whom on earth, to whom in God's name does this earth belong? Does it belong to the king who conquers it? Does it belong to the rich man who buys it? Does it belong to the warrior or swordsman who grabs it? And the man, the common man, who has neither the means of purchase, the means of snatching or grabbing, does this earth not belong to him? Is he not the inheritor of God's earth? But he has not even 3.5 feet of land to lay his head upon. He is hunted from pillar to post, not allowed to sleep under the bridges, not allowed to live on the pavement. The law in its supreme majesty forbids him to beg on the streets or steal bread. Friends, unless we have the courage and the will to change this social order from top to bottom, a radical change not only in the context but also in the consciousness of men, a radical change in our institutions, in our way of life, and in our thinking, in all realms of human consciousness. That is the supreme need of the times. And we have got to address ourselves to this task, which to many seems impossible. I have said more often than not, repeated almost ad nauseam, that the art of the possible is politics, but revolution is the art of making the impossible possible, the possible probable, and the probable feasible. Progress, after all, is our march from our grasp to our reach. What is in our grasp is already there, but from the grasp we have to progress towards our reach. And friends, our reach has no horizons. Did anybody in the world ever think that it would be possible to make for men to set foot on the moon, let alone the moon business? Had anyone even the faintest idea that independence would come to this country without an armed revolt or resurrection? Had we the remotest notion that a day would come when there would be no king on the face of India? But the day has dawned. The impossible has happened in spite of our philosophers of practicalism and men who were worldly wise. We have to forget, especially the young men, that there is such a thing as impossibility. The word impossible should not occur in the lexicon of youth. David Lloyd George was the Prime Minister of England during the First World War, just as Churchill was the Prime Minister of England during the Second World War. And he once addressed a gathering of young men. He began with the sentence, the motto, "Give me young men and I shall change the face of the earth." The young man knows no defeat. He takes failures in his stride. Failures inspire him to greater effort and more vigorous fight. That is what youth is. All else, everything else that goes by the name of youth is old age in garments borrowed from youth. So young men, doctors and medical men, I beseech you to take your stand on this point, that it is the last man, the inherited, the lowest, the lowliest, and the lost, who should be the maker of history in times to come. This is the age of democracy, the age of the common man. And the common man is one who doesn't wield the sword, who is not the soldier, who has no coffers filled with money, and who is not on the seats of government or power. That man who has made all these. After all, who makes the sword? Is it the soldier who shapes his sword? Is it the rich man who has shaped his coffers, made his coffers, his safes? Are those in power who have made their thrones? These are all man-made dignitaries. As Goldsmith said, a breath can make them as a breath has made. But a bold peasantry, their country's pride, can never be supplied. If it once decays, ill fares the land where wealth accumulates and men decay. So man as an individual, every man is unique, every man is a whole number, he is an integer, he is not a fraction. That's the view that we have got to adopt, that's the outlook which should inspire all our actions and activities in life. This is the first step, the second step, the third step, as well as the last step in any social change we want to begin with. Friends, social service is not a profession, nor is it a vocation. If it becomes a profession, it will become functional. And I beseech you to remember, all functionalism is color blind to all human values. Just as was the case with our caste system. It was based on vocation as well as on birth. And to our utter chagrin, and to our utter misfortune, we have never been able to develop any human values in the life of this country. That is why fate cursed us with slavery for centuries. A country which is proud of its spiritual heritage, a country which boasts of it, is never tired of boasting of its religiosity, has been more often slave than free. What's the reason? The reason is that we have never valued the dignity of man. Man has been constantly devalued in all our religion, philosophy, in all our culture. Perhaps this is the point from which we have to begin, the dignity of man. And you doctors are the most qualified. Qualified by your calling. You dissect corpses. You operate on bodies. You perform post-mortem examinations or carcasses. So you perform the work of the untouchable, the cobbler and the scavenger. According to our ancient codes of contact, the Shastras, the Vaidyas and the doctors are untouchables because they have to perform every blessed function in life, the lowest. So if you are touchable, why not the cobbler? Why not the scavenger? Why should he not be given the same treatment that you receive? He should have the same status, enjoy the same social amenities. But we have a diabolical social order in which man is shunned. Man's company is taboo. What, after all, is a caste system? In the caste system, the first distinctive characteristic of a good man who believes in caste is that he does not sit, does not dine, does not intermarry with other men. So though the more you shun the company of man, the purer you are. The farther off from man, the nearer to God. This is the first characteristic of the caste system. The second characteristic is that caste cannot be changed. You can't change it. Caste cannot be conferred or changed. One has to be born into a caste. So there is no door of entrance, but only a door of exit. This is second characteristic. And these two characteristics together mean that caste cannot teach us living with other men. Living together is life. There is no life without relationship. Alienation is not life. Specialization alienates. From alienation to kinship. From isolation to relationship. That is progress. All progress, all advance means approach. Bringing men closer to one another. This is the kind of revolution, or if you are allergic of that word, radical social change, for which we have got to work, and work with all our might and all our soul. Because unless the present social order is changed, take it from me. Humanity is not going to develop any cultural values whatsoever. The majority of human beings will always have to lead a sordid life, which will be more intolerable, a greater burden than the life of beasts of burden. That is why I have come to talk to you at my age. I have no interest in public speaking now. I have spoken to men gatherings, huge and small, for the last 60 years. And I have lost all zest for public speaking. I have come to you as I would go to my grandsons to be aware before it is too late. You are not living to oblige anybody. Today's young man is obsessed with the idea, is laboring under the delusion that he is living for everyone else except himself. He attends college not for himself, but to oblige his parents, his guardians, his teachers, his government, and if you will, his God, to oblige everyone except himself. This is vicarious living. This is spurious living. This is not life which is earnest. This is not life which is real. You have to face the situation as it is. And the situation today is that there are several students among you, among young men, who cannot afford sufficient clothing, who cannot get sufficient food to eat, who perhaps, there are some who belong to, who are sons of masters, and there are others who are sons of their servants. This master-servant relationship, this employer-employee relationship, this labor-capital relationship, this has got to go lock, stock and barrel. And it is in you, the young men, who have a whole span of life before you. My day is done. And perhaps I were nowhere else to look to. But you, the youth of the country, are both our hope and our mainstay. Not only the future, but also the present belongs to you. You have to decide for yourself. Don't take anything on credit from men of my generation or from men of the generations previous to me. Do not accept the authority of any book, any guru, or any teacher. Judge things for yourself. Face them for yourself. And face them with manfully. The problems you have to grapple. If others solve all problems for you, life will be insipid. It will lose its flavor. And youth is the bloom of life. If you have no faith, fundamental faith, faith unflinching that moves mountains. It is this faith, unflinching faith in the future and in yourselves. Remember, there is no end to history. There is no last chapter ever written in history. The next chapter has to be written by you in action. Once I was invited to a college to speak to the students of that college. A young man of 20 stood up and asked me, "Has it ever happened in the world that a country won its freedom without an armed struggle?" I said, "No, it has never happened in history." Then the young man said, "Then why do you come and talk to us? You should sit down silently." So I sat down. I said, "Is it your prerogative to ask a question?" "You could." And I asked him whether there was another example in history where a handful of people, about 1.5 lakh, came from over 6,000 miles and conquered and ruled 300,000 people for a period of 150 years. Can you cite another example from history? The young man said, "There is no record in history, because it has never happened. But it happened in India in 1857. It happened in this country. And we Indians have had the distinction of making this calamity, this impossible calamity, possible. So if we could work this miracle, couldn't we work another miracle? Is history made of people who are mere carbon copies of the previous generation? If that were so, history will be reduced to a railway timetable. It will never be written." So, young men of sense and of spirit, I appeal to you with all the earnestness that I can command to give your thought, and not only your thought, but dedicate your life, all your equipment, your intelligence and your strength to this mighty task of restaining the common man. He is the future maker of history, the future hero of history, the king, the warrior, the saint, and the prophet were makers of history in the past. We are waiting for the day. When the common man will not be the subject of history, the object of history, but the maker of history. And who is the common man? The man with the means and implements of production. Because it is the means and implements of production that give life. Arms and weapons do not give life, they take away life. So the future ought to be with the man with the plow, the man with the hammer and sickle, the man with the charkha and the loom, the man who tills the land, the man who with his labor makes things which make life possible and which enrich life. This is the man who ought to be the central figure of all our future order. He is the man who will be the sovereign of the democratic order which we want to bring about. And I have come to you in the hope and in the faith, coupled with my prayer, that God may give you the will, the strength, and the ambition to translate this dream into actuality. With this hope and prayer, I thank you all for the patient hearing that you have given me. Namaskar.